Welcome to Best of KPBS Podcast. I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, and today we're going to give you a sneak peek behind the curtain of two of KPBS's podcasts, Freeway Exit and Screen Time. First, we'll hear an excerpt from Freeway Exit, a podcast that explores the history of San Diego's urban freeway network. Afterwards, we'll sit down with host Andrew Bowen to take us behind the scenes of that podcast. Then we'll hear the first episode of Screen Time and meet with host Andrew Bracken to break down how that podcast sets out to be a guide for parents raising kids in the digital age. This is Best of KPBS Podcasts. Use of freeways is embedded into the culture of San Diego and Southern California, really in general. It's nearly impossible to navigate our widespread county without utilizing them. But how did freeways help to shape the development of the San Diego we know as of today? That's why Andrew Bowen is here. He's going to explore this and more in Freeway Exit. In the first episode, Andrew talks with activists who have a bold proposal for fixing the problems that freeways cause in our communities. Let's take a listen to this excerpt.
It's a few hours before sundown, and I'm walking through a network of hiking trails along the floor of one of San Diego's urban canyons. This canyon is part of Balboa Park, which is referred to as the city's crown jewel. 1,200 acres of open space, gardens, museums, the world-famous zoo, right in the center of the city. These trails are one of my favorite places in San Diego. The walls of the canyon make you feel totally immersed in nature. Sometimes you can see hummingbirds drinking from the wildflowers and darting around the tree canopy chasing after insects. Canyons are part of what makes San Diego special. They're little pockets of peace and quiet inside a metropolis of 1.4 million people.
You know, the way the canyons kind of reach up into the neighborhoods, I've always enjoyed.
My hiking buddy this afternoon is Brer Marsh. He's a local architect with a warm smile and salt and pepper hair that he pulls back into a ponytail. He also sits on the Balboa Park Committee, which advises the city on park matters. Like me, he has a deep appreciation for urban canyons. They've been a refuge for him since he first came to San Diego in 2001.
There's one near my first job over in Mission Hills where I could go and walk down it at lunch, and you wouldn't know that you were in the middle of a city. Even as we were walking down the trail, like, you would have no idea that there's a freeway about 500 feet away.
Not just any freeway, the Cabrillo Freeway, aka State Route 163. These trails lead right up to it. And as you approach, the canyon's tranquility gradually devolves into this. The 163 is a freeway unlike any other in San Diego. For starters, it was the first freeway ever built here. And it's the only one in the city that was subject to a referendum. Up until the 40s, Cabrillo Canyon had just a two-lane road. There was also a lily pond. The vote to allow a freeway through the canyon was held in March 1941. It passed with 89% support, one of the biggest landslides in city history.
My feeling at that time was progress was a word that people took seriously. San Diego was a much smaller town, and the idea of it growing and becoming better financially, compete with its neighbors up the state, and become more of a player on the map is something that we still feel. We still talk about ourselves in terms of how we relate to San Francisco or Los Angeles. If you try and sell progress to people that want to be bigger or better, they're going to buy it. It's an easy sell, I guess is what I'm saying.
The 163, then called Cabrillo Parkway, opened on February 28, 1948.
There was a parade or a procession that drove down the freeway for the first time. And when this sort of inaugural procession cleared the off-ramps, the barriers would be taken down, and there were lines of cars, people in cars, waiting to go drive on the new freeway. And they were instantly caught in traffic. There was so much interest and so much excitement about traveling on this new high-speed roadway that it was just a traffic jam.
Kind of ironic, right? A freeway whose main purpose was to relieve traffic saw gridlock the moment it opened. Anyway, Brayer has an affection for this freeway. You can see its age in the design. The barriers separating the lanes from the landscaped median aren't concrete like with most freeways. They're wood posts, just a few feet high.
Newer freeways have a larger right-of-way, bigger setbacks. They tend to have dividers between the road and houses, fences on the bridges to keep people from throwing things or jumping off them. The standards that this freeway was built with, there were no standards really, right?
Something else that sets the 163 apart is its beauty, or more specifically, the beauty you witness while driving on it. In the spring, the walls of Cabrillo Canyon are blanketed in wildflowers. And then there's the view of Cabrillo Bridge, with its seven Spanish-style arches towering 120 feet in the air. It was built in 1914 to connect Balboa Park's west and central mesas over the canyon.
I had an old motorcycle, and I used to ride it down the 163 to downtown and then back up to Hillcrest when I was playing with carburetor settings. And I loved it. I mean, it's a really lovely road to ride on. It has that quality that only old roads have. It's the way they draw the arcs and the curves and the ups and the downs of the road surface that modern engineers intentionally avoid. And there's also that moment where you pass under the bridge and you can kind of hear the echo of the exhaust, and it's exhilarating.
One day in 2014, Brayer got a chance to experience the 163 on a completely different level. The part of the freeway that goes through Balboa Park was closed for a construction project. Brayer was going for a run just before dawn. And for the first time ever, he saw the freeway with no cars on it.
I just kind of went through an opening and went for a walk down to check out what was happening. And I would say it was like going back in time a little bit. The quiet and, you know, the early morning light. And I don't know how to describe it, but there's something about being in a space where you're not allowed to be any longer because of the infrastructure that's been put there, that it kind of gets you thinking about what you're missing out on. I don't want to say in that moment I thought, hey, this needs to change. That's not true. It was like the start of an idea, right? An idea that I didn't really think about more until I went to architecture school and started learning more about cities and the urban environment.
So tell me what this idea is.
The short version of the idea is that the 163 should be closed.
From KPBS in San Diego, this is Freeway Exit. I'm Andrew Bowen. In this series, we're looking at how San Diego's relationship with the freeway has changed over time, and how it will have to change in the future. To accommodate a growing population that's sick and tired of being stuck in traffic, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and leave a better planet for our kids and grandkids, and to heal the wounds that freeways have inflicted on people and neighborhoods. What's the most extreme route to those objectives? Decommissioning. Closing a freeway to traffic. If that sounds crazy to you, consider this. San Diego has committed to achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2035. Hitting that goal in 12 years will require changes to our behavior and our infrastructure that are so colossal, so dramatically different from what we know now. It's hard to wrap our heads around it. But let's try. Net zero greenhouse gas emissions means no new greenhouse gases sent into the atmosphere. Cars could still burn gasoline, but all of their emissions would have to be recaptured, either the old-fashioned way, using trees and photosynthesis, or using carbon capture technology that doesn't exist yet, at least not at scale. Now, the city does plan on planting more trees, though it's not happening fast enough, and the trees we already have aren't always well maintained. And it would take literally hundreds of millions of new trees to fully offset the city's carbon footprint. So what's a more realistic pathway to carbon neutrality? Reducing emissions. To the point where everything that we emit is reabsorbed by the natural environment. Most of our emissions come from transportation, about 55%. And while electric vehicles will reduce emissions somewhat, they won't be nearly enough. Thousands of people are buying brand new gas-powered vehicles today, and they'll be on the road for decades past our deadline of 2035. The unavoidable truth is that San Diego needs to dramatically reduce the amount of driving that takes place on its streets and freeways. And that shift needs to happen fast, like yesterday.
As a city and as a society, I think we're moving past the era of abundant freeways. I think people are coming to the realization that cars are having a significant impact on our environment, a negative impact on our cities. Despite all of the great opportunity they provide, we can't ignore the social and environmental impacts that come along with them.
Decommission is a word you've probably heard in reference to naval ships or maybe an old power plant. It's when a society says, this public asset has served its purpose. We don't need it anymore, and it's time to turn it over to another use. Seoul, South Korea decommissioned a freeway and turned the land back into a natural stream. Rochester, New York decommissioned part of its inner loop highway and turned it into a boulevard. There was enough space left over to build more than 500 homes, most of them affordable. On the 163, Breyer isn't suggesting we decommission the entire freeway, just the roughly 2-mile stretch that goes through Balboa Park. When he tells people about this idea, the typical reaction he gets is horror. Why would you close this freeway? How would I get anywhere without it? Where he tries to steer the conversation is what would go in the freeway's place.
When you start talking about taking space away from cars, people want to fill it with things that they think that are missing, right? That are missing from the neighborhood and from the city.
For most of us, freeways have always been there. They're deeply ingrained into our culture. So, of course, it seems radical to talk about chipping away at that system, even for just a few miles. But like I said, if San Diego is really committed to taking action on climate change, it has to cut back on driving by a lot. And freeways are the backbone of our car culture.
Hey, mujer. Hola,
Ashley. To people like Julie Corrales, freeways are also symbols of inequality and division.
You're gonna get the food? Where's the food at?
Julie is gathering a group of 10 people in a high school classroom in Logan Heights, a few miles southeast of downtown. This neighborhood used to be a lot bigger before I-5 split it down the middle.
¿Quién estamos esperando? ¿Sabemos?
Julie is an organizer with the Environmental Health Coalition, or EHC. It's a nonprofit that works to reduce pollution and improve the health and well-being of people in underserved communities. This is a meeting of one of EHC's community advisory teams, which try to get regular people involved in policymaking.
I love it!
Gosh, I love it!
That's the best.
Julie has an infectious laugh. Her friendly banter with the group make it clear she absolutely loves her job.
It took forever, first of all. It took me like two...
I'm just messing with you, sis.
After some eating and socializing, the group gets down to business.
Has anyone heard of Boston Avenue Park? Yeah? Yeah, I'm so excited. So, el parque que estamos diseñando en la calle Boston, ahí donde está el freeway, toda esa área.
In about a week, Caltrans is going to break ground on a new park in Barrio Logan. the section of Greater Logan Heights that was cut off by I-5. The park will go along a long, skinny strip of land that nudges up against the freeway. Julia is hoping everyone will go to the press conference to show their support.
I've been trying to vision that park, and I just can't see it yet.
I mean, I think that's why the tour is going to be so great, because we're going to walk the space, and it's a really big space. It's all ice plant right now.
Yeah.
There's going to be a plaza, like a stage, and a plaza, basketball courts, community gardens.
The group is clearly excited about getting a new park in a neighborhood that is seriously lacking in green space. And they're already thinking bigger. They don't want to stop at the edge of the freeway. They want a park that stretches over the freeway and reconnects the two sides of Logan Heights that have been divided for more than 60 years. A freeway lid.
That was an excerpt from the first episode of Freeway Exit, hosted by Andrew Bowen, who joins me now, who's going to give us a behind-the-scenes look at the podcast. Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Lawrence, I'm good.
Good. Thank you for your time. Thanks for being here. I want to start with the inspiration behind the project. What initially piqued your interest in even wanting to explore the history and development of San Diego's freeways?
So I moved to San Diego in the fall of 2015, and I actually flew into Los Angeles Airport and was driving down to San Diego. And there was this moment when I was driving on the 5 going south, and I suddenly saw the Pacific Ocean appear. I was feeling a lot of anxiety about moving to San Diego and knowing that my life and my transportation was going to change. I had just left Germany, where I lived for 6 years, and never drove a car there. And, you know, that moment of seeing the ocean and noticing just, you know, where this freeway takes up space, it gave me a sense of relief knowing, you know, that the ocean will always be there and I will always have this view. You know, in the past 10 or 11 years that I've been covering San Diego politics, freeways come up again and again and again. And a lot of people are telling stories about, you know, when freeways were constructed or the displacement that they caused, the division that they left in communities. And so much of the debates that I was watching were about freeways. How much should we be spending on freeways? Should we be building new ones? Should we be widening the ones that exist today? And if so, what is the purpose? What's our goal with that? So I just kind of felt like there was a lot of forgotten history, and I wanted to learn it myself. I wanted to share it with others and also just kind of start a conversation about some big, bold ideas of, you know, how we can create the San Diego that we want.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree. Not being from San Diego as well, coming over from the East Coast. The first episode starts off with a bang. You explore the idea of decommissioning and or closing the 163. Obviously, this is controversial here. Talk to us about the response you got from that episode. Is it almost like walking on eggshells? It's a passionate topic.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people about this idea. I think it's important and helpful for people to know the history of, you know, when the freeway was created, how it wasn't always there, and, you know, what kind of a city San Diego was at that time in the late 40s, and what kind of city we are today. All of the different freeways that have been built to sort of supplement the 163, providing that connection into downtown. I think the reception I've got, you know, a lot of people are like, well, that's never going to happen. So, you know, why bother thinking about it? Other people are intrigued. You know, they wonder, like, what would the space turn into if it's not a freeway? Like, what would we use that space for? And that's where I think, you know, the conversation can get interesting, because sometimes people have their own ideas. Sometimes people say, like, I would love just more park space, more hiking trails, more like a bike superhighway, you know, that you could ride a bike on what currently is the freeway, but, you know, have it take you downtown and enjoy the beautiful scenery that, you know, if you've driven on the 163 through Balboa Park, it's like probably the prettiest scenic view of any freeway in San Diego. And you only get to experience it for a split second because you're driving down that road and going somewhere. So I think the reception is typically like, I don't want to say cold, but, you know, intrigued, I guess. People are interested in this idea, how it might work and what might go in the freeway's place.
Were there any other episodes that caused a stir or maybe hopefully we can say sparked progressive conversation among listeners?
Well, episode 3, we get into the history of the neighborhood of South Crest in San Diego and the history of Highway 252, which was proposed to go right through the neighborhood, connection between the 5 and the 805. I was very pleased that a lot of people, when they heard that episode, they told me they had never heard that history before. I mean, I didn't know that history before I started working on the podcast. And one really cool thing that happened subsequently, as more people started learning about this piece of history and Highway 252 and the revolt against to stop the highway, there was actually an exhibition at the San Diego History Center that looked into some of these stories of neighborhoods that were divided by freeways. They found a lot more primary sources related to the fight against Highway 252 than I was able to find in the time that I had to produce the podcast. And they also had a bigger team. There was a research assistant, a student at UCSD, who reached out to me, and I shared with her some leads on, you know, where she could find more primary source materials to really get into the details of this history. They found, you know, newsreels from the 70s that, you know, with interviews from folks who were involved in that story. I also found some photos from the Union Tribune sent their photos that they had in their archives to the History Center, and was able to see, you know, some actual images of these city council meetings that I had heard a recording of, but never actually got to see, you know, what it looked like in the room with, like, people holding up signs saying, you know, Highway 252 is racial injustice. I'm not quoting, but, you know, it's something along those lines. And that, I think, you know, was an episode that I hear a lot of people mention as like, wow, that piece of local history people were totally unaware of.
Once again, this is Andrew Bowen, host of Freeway Exit with us. Since starting the project, Bowen, has your own view on highways or freeways changed at all? Has it impacted your opinions on them? Knowing, maybe you're almost burdened with knowledge now?
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to start a conversation about freeways with me because I will talk your ear off. I don't know if my opinion on freeways has changed so much. I think the things that I knew about freeways before are still true, and I still know them today. They are huge sources of air pollution in a lot of communities. The noise is something that I've started paying a lot more attention to, just how loud freeways are. If you are standing, you know, outside of a car, if you're just walking or whatever, that it can be really hard to hear somebody talking, even when they're right next to you, over that noise of the freeway. And the research into noise pollution and its impacts on public health have also, you know, that's a growing area of research. We're learning more about correlations between high levels of noise pollution and dementia or other cognitive conditions that, you know, can reduce somebody's lifespan or quality of life. The other element to the freeways that I think I have a new perspective on after this podcast is just that they are not necessarily going to exist forever. When we look at San Diego in the time span of, you know, its founding as a sort of a European settler colony, you know, to today, there were no freeways at the start, obviously, and now there are many. And these freeways also have an expiration date. I mean, the infrastructure, concrete and reinforced concrete, is not meant to last for all eternity. And there will come a day when we have to consider, you know, how to replace them or whether to replace them. And, you know, learning about the story of the Embarcadero Freeway in San Francisco, which we cover in episode 5, and another freeway in San Francisco, the Central Freeway, both were heavily damaged in an earthquake, and the city ultimately took the step of removing those freeways and repurposing the land that was underneath them. Those kinds of stories, I think, have really expanded my understanding of what's possible. But I think it's worth thinking about and exploring in San Diego because, again, like as you heard in the episode, we have very ambitious goals with addressing climate change and improving people's quality of life. And so, you know, we have to understand and think about how freeways fit into that.
Freeway Exit is still a living and breathing project. We have episodes forthcoming. What are the plans for it in the future, Andrew Bowen?
Well, you know, I'm releasing these bonus episodes when I've got the time and the inspiration. It's always a challenge balancing that with, you know, the daily responsibilities of being the Metro reporter here at KPBS. There's a lot of news always happening. And so I will continue to be looking for those opportunities, interesting ideas or conversations that I can have with people about freeways. There are more episodes in the works. I can't really say more than that at this point. But, you know, there are some really fascinating stories that have emerged both from season 1, you know, after that concluded, updates to ideas and events that I explored in season one, as well as, you know, whole new ideas and stories about freeways, even in my own life and my own personal history that I plan on working into future podcast episodes.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Talk to us about the digital series that serves as really as a companion to Freeway Exit. Can you talk to me about that?
You know, there are a lot of places in San Diego that almost became freeways but did not. And Highway 252 in South Crest is one of them. But there are a few others. And, you know, these are little stories in San Diego history that I learned but couldn't really find a place for in the podcast. So we were talking about neighborhood opposition to freeways. And it's important to understand in a lot of these debates about building a freeway here or there, there was almost always some opposition. It mattered who was opposing the freeway. There are systems and structures of power that, you know, gave some people more privilege, more clout to be able to succeed in stopping a freeway, and other neighborhoods, predominantly, you know, low income or communities of color, were by and large less successful at actually stopping a freeway, even if they had all of the organizing power and, you know, the facts were on their side. We generally saw a lot of freeways get crumble under the pressure of opposition from wealthy white homeowners. And I think that's also important for us to understand and remember.
Absolutely. I thank you. And I thank you for shining a light on that reporting. For someone who hasn't listened to Freeway Exit yet, what would you like a new listener to take away from Freeway Exit?
I'd like people to know more about the city that they live in, the origins of the city, and how it became the city that it is today. And I'd also like for people to feel empowered to imagine a different city in the future, you know, and also feel like they have some agency and they have some ability to shape that future. The number of people who actually engage meaningfully with local government is pretty small. And I would love for that to be, you know, to be a more common thing, that, you know, people actually feel like their voice matters, that they know how and when to engage with their representative government and how to shape those decisions, and start thinking about what is the San Diego that they want to see in the future and how can they be a part of making it happen.
Awesome. A podcast with a purpose. I've been speaking with Andrew Bowen, the host of the KPBS podcast Freeway Exit. Bowen. Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lawrence. It was a pleasure.
We will be back after the break for a look into the KPBS podcast Screen Time. In it, host Andrew Bracken explores how parents are navigating raising children in the digital age. Best of KPBS podcast returns after the break. Welcome back to Best of KPBS Podcast. I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, host and producer of San Diego News Now, KPBS's daily news podcast. Today, we're exploring two KPBS podcasts. Next up is Screen Time. In it, host Andrew Bracken explores how the digital age is shaping the next generation and what parents should do about it. In this first episode, Bracken talks to Dr. Michael Rich, a pediatrician and founder of the Digital Wellness Lab, about his advice for families.
So one of the defining questions for parents today is how much screen time is too much. What do you say to parents when you get that question?
Well, I say, for one thing, we can no longer measure screen time because of the way kids use them. We all, but kids in particular, move seamlessly in between the digital and the physical space. So the old days of television where you sat down in front of a screen and watched a 1 hour or a 2 hour show and turned it off at the end are gone, long gone. But the whole concept of limiting screen time really originated and has persisted from there. Having worked in this area since the days of television, I will tell you that screen time limits didn't even work then, when we could measure screen time, in part because we treated them as the forbidden fruit. Kids came home from school and did their full hour or 2 hours of quality screen time. And then at the end of that time, what happened? Absolutely nothing. But then mom or dad would come up the stairs and say, you've got homework to do, or you wanted to go outside and play basketball, whatever. And the kids would say, oh, can I watch the rest of this show? Or can I level up in this game? And it would be a conflict every single time. What we are now looking at in terms of a way of controlling that is actually to have dedicated non-screen time. In other words, time when screens are not in use, when phones are not in pockets. And I think this works better to develop the kind of healthy, diverse menu of experiences you want for your child during the day, because we can't measure screen time, but we can measure time that we put it all down, is, I think, the most effective way of taking care of them.
This idea that screen time has become immeasurable, focusing on that, is it less about the total amount of screen time and more about the ways we're using screens or what we're kind of using when we're on screens? How do you view that?
You've actually nailed it right on the head. It is how we are using screens that affects us. The issue of screen time is not so much that screen time is inherently toxic, so much as what it displaces. What we are not doing because we're on a screen. We are not, taking a walk in the woods or having a conversation with our parents or doing our homework or, frankly, getting sleep and a decent meal. So I think that it's really more about how we use the screens. Obviously, the content of those screens is very important, but also the context of our use of them. When, where, and how we are using them, that really makes a huge difference. And so I think that refocusing on the issue of how we use screens is more important than trying to measure how much time we're using them for.
And on how we use screens, I mean, one thing that I always come back to is it's also about how us as parents use screens.
Oh, yeah.
And on this sort of idea of like screen time use and how we screen, we have a rule in our home. This is sort of embarrassing, but, we don't do double screening where you're watching one screen and you're interacting with another screen. But, just last week I was watching Lawrence of Arabia, this classic film. And, my children will call me out on this double screening. And, in this case, I was reading about the real Lawrence of Arabia on Wikipedia as I was watching the movie. Should we be worrying about our digital habits like that and just kind of updating those? Or is that just kind of getting too not focused on the right things?
You touched on a whole bunch of interesting things in that question. First is you talked about having rules at home. One of the things that I actually encourage the kids I care for and their parents to do is switch from rules to expectations. And the reason for that is that rules are things that come down from on high, the parents saying this for the kids. Expectations are what we have of each other. And I am so proud of your kids for calling you out because that was you not meeting their expectations or actually your family's expectations for everybody. So give them a high five for me on that one. because you were missing out on one of the greatest films of all time in your attempt to multitask. One of the things that we think we can do but actually cannot is multitask. Finally, what I would say, it is actually what the parents do that matters. And that brings forward what I call the five M's of raising children in a media-saturated world. The first M is to model the behavior with screens that you want them to see, because they will do what they see you do. They listen to about 1% of what you say, but 100% of what you do. The second is to mentor them in the use of screens. And the reason I use the word mentor is that when you think about teaching, that's sort of a one-way thing of the teacher teaching the child. Parents resist not being the expert in the room. And they, they say to me, I really dread the internet talk more than I dread the sex talk, because rightly or wrongly, they think they know something about sex, but they're convinced they don't know enough about the internet to teach their kids. But mentors learn as much from the mentee as the mentee learns from the mentor. It is really a dialogue of learning that goes on. And so I encourage parents to sit down next to their kid who wants to get a smartphone or wants to get on social media or wants, you know, to get a certain video game, and do it with their child. Learn together with them. That does a couple of things. Number one is that it, you know, helps the parent know what the child wants to do. It also helps the parent help the child think about what this means, you know, what could happen, what might occur unexpectedly, et cetera. But also, perhaps most importantly, it opens the door to ongoing conversation about the child's digital life. The reality is that they spend much of their wakeful time using screens in one way or another. So we have to be present in their lives there. The third and the most controversial, perhaps, M, with both parents and kids, is that parents need to be able to monitor their child's digital lives. They need to have their usernames and passwords, not because they're going to be surveilling them all the time. And that's what parents push back against. I don't have the time to go everywhere she goes online. And the kids, of course, push back against, I want my privacy. Unfortunately, to, you know, a 13-year-old, privacy means so mom and dad can't see. So I encourage them to do it because if they can monitor their child's behaviors online, the child's behaviors change in response. Now, if we can adhere to those three M's, there are two M's that are the goodies that come out of it. First of all, is you are helping your children master this incredibly powerful tool, incredibly powerful environment, and to use it in effective ways to learn, to connect with people, to be a part of a larger digital world. And also, when they master it, they recognize when it is not the best tool for the job at hand, and they put it down and they cook a meal with you. They have a conversation with you. They take a walk with you. And those are where we make memories.
You mentioned monitoring, and I think you refer to it as something that might be kind of controversial. How do you break down what healthy monitoring looks like?
Open conversations about it. In other words, I do not think parents should be sneakily seeing what their kids do. But I also think that they want to keep the door open for that so that kids don't get trapped in a situation that they can't handle. I think that it is so important for parents to approach their kids' digital lives not with blame and shame, not with judgment, but with curiosity and creativity, that they are curious about what their children are doing, not to be nosy, but out of respect and love for them. That's why I will tell parents, don't wag your finger at the top of the basement stairs and say, stop playing Grand Theft Auto. Walk down those stairs, sit next to your son and play the game with him.
So you're involved in a lot of research involving kids and screens at the Digital Wellness Lab. There seem to be new studies being published kind of every day on the topic. I'm just curious from a high level, what has surprised you most when it comes to research on kids and the role technology is playing in childhood today?
I guess what has surprised me the most is the way we as a public have actually responded to the research. It's sort of like we glom onto all the badness instead of realizing that it is something that, first of all, is not going away. So we need to learn to live well with it. But we seem to ignore all the positives. What I really am surprised by mostly is that for whatever reason, we seem to move very quickly to fear as opposed to implementing the things that are really helpful to us and to our children and their future.
Well, and I think that can also lead, that fear can also lead to a lot of, I don't know, parental guilt and anxiety, which I think is something that a lot of parents experience. I've definitely struggled with that. Obviously, you treat children, but you also end up treating the parents. Like, how do you gauge the level of stress parents feel about technology, and how do you guide them around that?
I urge them to dump the guilt. What's been done is done. We need to be looking forward and how we can improve it. When I was a kid, seatbelts weren't even in cars, right? Should we feel guilty that, you know, or my parents feel guilty that they drove me around in cars without seatbelts? Or should we be glad we have them now, use them effectively, and understand that there will be improvements in the future that will be even better than this? You know, airbags then came in, et cetera. But also not to waste the energy on the guilt. What's done is done. Let's look forward. Let's take care of our kids with all we have learned, some of it by what's gone wrong. And what do we avoid? What do we do differently? And so I encourage parents to communicate with their kids, allow their kids to communicate with them and really listen to them. One of the things that I do that's fairly subversive with my teenage patients is I'll ask them, once their parents are out of the room, what could your parents do better? And almost always the first thing out of their mouth is, pay more attention to me. They feel like they're cut off from their parents. They feel like their parents are staring at their smartphones and are engaged in other more important things. And the parents think the kids never say anything, never, you know, they're just sullen and you know, moody. And the kids really want to be connected with their parents. But they're also negotiating what the nature of that connection is going to be like, because they are crossing the river from childhood to adulthood, and they're seeking their own autonomy in their own terms. So I think that you're absolutely right that fear and guilt are sort of ruling the parental approach to all of this. And I want to turn that on its head and say, yes, we can do this. We just have to remember our humanity, our values as we bring them to the kids, and to use research such that we do, use that kind of research to guide our choices going forward.
That was Dr. Michael Rich speaking with Screen Time host Andrew Bracken in the first episode of the podcast. And Andrew Bracken joins me now. Hey, Bracken.
Hey, Lawrence. How's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Good. It's weird to be on this seat, but I'm excited.
I'm sure you'll get used to it quickly. Talk to me first about the inspiration for Screen Time, Bracken.
You know, I'm a dad of two kids, right? My kids are kind of in that middle school transitioning to high school era, but in their lifetime, technology has shifted so much. How we use technology, how we watch, let's say screens, to, you know, it's not the same way I watched TV as a kid. It's just transformed so much. And what I noticed was more and more, whether it was, you know, talking to other parents, whether it was conversations with my own kids, is more and more the conversation went back to, you know, what are you doing about iPads? What are you doing about the, you know what I mean? It came back to technology. And I just kind of wanted to ask some questions about that and how that's impacting childhood.
Absolutely. Big impacts. I feel like, you know, the difference is the kids these days grew up with it already. Whereas I can say, at least my generation, I was in like middle elementary school when I got a screen. Whereas kids now, it's almost like,
and for me, like
born
I'm
with them.
I'm an earlier generation, exactly, so yep. It was even much different. But one aspect of it to me is also like with these iPads, with these personal devices, mm-hmm. a lot of times we're experiencing this technology, we're watching this media in a very solitary way, whereas like in my childhood, when I watched cartoons, it was on in the living room or whatever. So there's lots of dynamics, but you're right. It kind of just impacts a lot of our lives.
Throughout the podcast, you speak with a variety of different people from different backgrounds, psychologists, pediatricians, researchers. Was there one interview in particular that stood out to you, Andrew?
A couple come to mind, and there were a couple different parts of this project. We really wanted to explore it from different dynamics, and there's a lot more on our website at kpbs.org/screentime. And one thing we did a little video interviews of young people talking about their own experiences, sort of as like a counter to all the experts and parental experts and researchers talking about the topic. We also wanted to hear from like teens, and they had really insightful things to say. I felt like, I want to say almost like I learned as much from just listening to them as these, you know, PhDs and doctors and things, which also were really insightful.
from the technology community, was there any criticism in regards to Screen Time Podcast?
This is tricky. No, I wouldn't say there's like specific, you know, criticism from the tech side. I think there's still a lot of debates happening over what we know, how much the technology is impacting kids, how it's doing it. And there are different findings coming out of the research. And I think that was pretty interesting. It's just during the course of this project, Jonathan Haidt released The Anxious Generation, which was just like this, you know, huge book that really kind of unleashed this topic and got folks talking about it. But talking to all the researchers and people working on this work, people had different reactions to the research and different, you know, findings of their own that may have been counter to what some of these research that had more strict, really kind of dire consequences from the technology. So there is like debates there, I guess I should say.
Bracken, being a father yourself, have you ever implemented any new strategies or practices into your own household that you learned about while creating or working on Screen Time?
Totally. And it changes all the time. One thing that I also, but when you're talking about technology and childhood, is not only the technology is changing each month, each year, but the kid is changing. Every kid's different too, right? One of the big ones that I walked away from was the idea of kind of removing the device at night and protecting sleep. Like that, the importance of, you know, adolescence and sleep, just that came through across the board. So really trying to kind of create spaces where that technology is off or it's away or it's, you know, from a distance. And I'll say this is not just like, you know, me as a parent, but this is also for myself as well. You know, I have to add the asterisk. It's like I'm not batting 1,000 with it, right? So it's not a perfection thing, but that would be one real big piece of it, is like trying to create space away from technology.
Any of these research or these kind of new pieces, does any of it potentially put into question adding new technology into your life? Have you found yourself hesitant?
I'm definitely more thoughtful before allowing a new piece of technology into my home or things like that. I mean, one thing that I think of is right now in San Diego, Waymos are doing the test drive. And they haven't gone public yet. These are these like robot taxis. I am a little more hesitant about those than I think I would have been before working on this project. You know, we just heard this conversation with Dr. Michael Rich, and one thing that, you know, stuck with me from his words were just like just having rules around screens and just the fact that you're thinking about it goes a long way.
Andrew, you launched this project, Screen Time, back in June of 2025. And really, honestly, since then, so much has changed in terms of legislature, research, even new forms of screens. Is there a new policy or research that you're especially excited to see come to light?
I mean, you're right. There's so much has changed. There's been like a sizable sea change just in the space. I think the largest one that happened late last year was Australia passed the first real like social media ban for kids under 16. People are already, you know, I think the United Kingdom is also already making an effort. There's, you know, lots of countries are looking to do something similar, but they were the first one to really take a crack at this thing. And their solution was to prevent, you know, 15 and unders from using these. And this includes like YouTube and Instagram, Snapchat, a whole bunch of stuff. And so now some of the findings of how that's gone are coming through, and that's a little interesting. And I think its impact, they published some initial findings. So I think right now the impact is it was less, I don't know, perhaps seismic than they expected and easier to get around, and young people could still use this stuff. But that's been one sort of like direction, right, is governments looking at all out banning it or changing how it looks. And I feel like that's kind of the way it's going to go, is like these technologies would be around, but maybe the experience would be a little different. You've seen it already with like, you know, Instagram teen accounts, right? They're kind of like still want to keep the connection open, keep it working, but try to limit some of the features, some of the open-ended access in some of these platforms. But that's kind of where my focus is right now.
When you were interviewing people for Screen Time, did you talk with anyone who was developing a form of new technology? Did you talk to anyone putting together a new app or some sort of new, what would be defined from your podcast as a Screen Time technology?
Yeah, so there are some sort of like more academic, like they'll try to create social media networks. Because that was one question I had, is it's like, what is a more healthy social media world look like? One researcher I spoke with at UCSD, we were talking about algorithms, and she used this, I don't know, just to explain how algorithms work, because I find them kind of mysterious to me, like why some video.
Where did this come from?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like what were the connections that decided for you to give me that video, which could be great and it could be really inappropriate mm-hmm. to me, and I find like, you know, and she kind of used this illusion of just like, baking a cake with all these different ingredients. And it's like, you know, there's tons of different algorithms and they all kind of work and weave around each other to create this experience that we each get. And of course, your feed is different than my feed. Trying to like, you know, look behind the curtain a little bit's important, but it's challenging.
If we were to look behind the curtain at the future, what would be next for Screen Time Podcast?
Well, we have one episode coming up. We were talking about these social media bans. And I spoke with Manoush Zamarodi. She is from NPR. She has this book called Body Electric. And she's been kind of looking into research behind how technology is shaping our physical bodies and how it's transforming our, you know, physical health, things like that. And she definitely had some kind of words of caution of just this ban approach. I think like her research is more about like how do we use technology but also take breaks and get away from it in a healthy way and kind of have it fit into our lives in a much more sustainable way for us. One of the lasting things to me is just that this is not just about kids, this issue of technology and how we use it, right? So I'm really interested in just family and technology. I think there's so many interesting questions I have of like how our parents, our grandparents are using technology. It's not just about, you know, kids playing video games. It impacts us all. So I think that's ultimately the direction where I kind of want to take the series.
I've been speaking with Screen Time host and producer Andrew Bracken. Bracken, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lawrence.
You've been listening to Best of KPBS Podcasts. Each episode brings you extended excerpts from some of KPBS's most compelling podcasts, along with conversations that take you behind the scenes of the journalism and storytelling that make these programs possible. Best of KPBS Podcasts is a production of the KPBS Audio Department. This episode was produced by Brandon Trufa. Executive producer and editor is KPBS Director of Audio Programming and Operations, Lisa Jane Morissette, with additional editorial support from senior producer Brooke Ruth and today's guests, Andrew Bowen and Andrew Bracken. I'm your host, Lawrence K. Jackson. Thanks for listening.